This is Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
But it was all for Chuck McGee.
Super Saver wins the Derby for Top Pletcher.
The Salt will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And dialed in, never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Presented by Basic Tipton. Now, here's Mike Penna.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to the show Trainers Listen To. It is Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, flying solo this evening as the Pontiff of the Pick Four, taking a little time off before we segue into the Belmont Stakes on June 11th. Do want to welcome everybody joining us throughout North America on Sirius 220, XM Channel 206, and of course, everyone tuning in worldwide with our live streaming on your computer, your mobile device, whatever it might be. It's all there at horseracingradio.net. And remember, you can check out a podcast of this show and all of our Trainer Talk shows on our website each and every week as well. Well, every week I have the privilege of visiting with those individuals that make our sport a success, and they are a part of a big puzzle that is thoroughbred racing. And you know I'm talking about the trainers. And tonight's guest is no exception. He has won 2,663 races. His runners have earned more than $38 million in purses. How about this? His first graded stakes winner came in 1984 with Hall of Famer Mom's Command. His most recent graded stakes victory came on May 21st of this year with Always Sunshine, who scored in the Grade 3 Maryland Sprint Handicap. Of course, I'm talking about trainer Ned Allard, who joins us now on Trainer Talk presented by Phasic Tipton. Ned, welcome to the program.
Well, it's good to be on.
Yeah, happy to have you on board. Boy, it's been quite a ride since Mom's Command, hasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, the whole game is very interesting. It's kind of like riding a roller coaster, because when you've got some good ones, you're up high, and when there aren't any good ones in the barn, you're kind of down the bottom of the roller coaster. But all in all, it's a business you do. If you didn't make any money and things weren't so hot, you'd still want to do it because, you know, it's a love of horses. It started as a childhood hobby and develops into a way of trying to make a living.
Where did the Ned Allard story begin?
Well, in 1945, my father bought a summer home on a lake in Windham, New Hampshire, which is the town next to Salem where Rockingham was. And as a 10-year-old, I was helping our neighbor get some water skis out of his trunk, and I noticed a horse on the front of his car, and I asked him what that was doing there. He said, "You'd have to get up at 5 in the morning to find out." What possessed me to go sit on his doorstep the next day, I can't tell you, but he brought me out to the track, and it was love at first sight. Wanted to be a jock and the whole nine yards. So 1957, I went to work for George Handy as a very young man, just walking horses, and stayed with him until 1970 and, you know, progressed from a hot walker to an exercise boy to his assistant trainer.
Wow. And you talk about being love at first sight. That was very much my first experience at the racetrack as well, and I was hooked for life. What was it about the sport and about being around the racetrack that attracted you to the game, Ned?
Well, probably my grandfather was a dairy farmer and in New Hampshire, and I always loved animals. I liked dogs, I liked horses, I liked cows, you name it. And I think the beauty of the thoroughbreds at the racetrack and the whole nine yards, it was just an exciting thing to witness, and it bit me.
Tell me about working around the track in those early days and what it was like learning the sport from that side of things.
Well, George Handy was my mentor, and he was one of the leading trainers in New England year after year. In fact, at 93, he's still training horses in Florida, a dear friend, still wins races, an amazing guy. So coming up under George Handy was a not only a great learning experience, but it was a lot of fun. And he's still a fun guy, and he still wins races, and just an amazing guy.
Will you still stay in contact with him? You mentioned you're still dear friends. Will you stay in contact?
I talk to him. I talk to him when he wins a race. I call him on his birthday. We stay in touch.
For people that don't remember Rockingham, and I grew up in western Massachusetts in a town called Pittsfield, so
I
remember Rockingham very well, and I used to call it the mini Saratoga because you can go there and have a picnic at the top of the stretch, and you can enjoy a great day of racing. It was a beautiful place. Tell people about Rockingham and what that racetrack was all about.
Well, you know, they built it in 1906. Lou Smith, I don't know whether he actually started it, but at one point I liked Rockingham, the old Rockingham, just as much as I like Saratoga. It was a beautiful place, lots of lakes. Canobie Lake was there. Benson's Wild Animal Farm was there. It was just a great place to be. They had some of the top horses and the top horsemen in the country stabled there during the summer meets. So it was just a very exciting part of my life.
People forget that when Rockingham was really rolling, it was as good as Saratoga. You had all the big-name horses, the big-name trainers, and as you just said, the big-name jockeys there for the meet.
Sure. And in Rhode Island, too. I mean, Suffolk Downs and Narragansett, you know, they had horses like Whirlaway and Citation. I mean, they had some of the biggest names in horse racing at the time.
Was it a difficult day when Rockingham finally closed?
Well, I was there the year it was caught on fire, and I'm thinking that was like 74 or something like that, maybe a little later than that, 78. And it happened at 6:30 in the morning, and I just couldn't believe it. And I thought that they'd put up a tent and the meet would go on, but it didn't. And that's when I ended up coming into the mid part of this New Jersey. I raced at Monmouth, the Delaware, Philadelphia Park, the Meadowlands. And then it did get started back up with the Carnies, but they weren't able to light a fire under the game like it had been before. You know, the competition for the dollar has gotten so great that a lot of racetracks just couldn't make it.
Yeah, it's a shame. And all the fair circuit that was throughout Massachusetts with Northampton, and you had, Brockton and Weymouth.
Brockton,
and
Barrington, Marshfield, and, you know, Narragansett, Lincoln Downs, what was Green Mountain?
Yeah, Green Mountain.
The place up in Old Orchard Beach. Can't even think of the name of that one offhand. But anyway, now there's just one. Suffolk Downs is the only place left. And they're running 2 days, three times this year. So, I mean, it's sad.
What kind of a teacher was George Handy?
He was a great teacher. You know, he and I have won about the same amount of races over the years. But he was a good horseman. He won a lot of races, and he was a lot of fun to be with. You know, we used to get horses from Buddy Jacobson. We used to get horses from Eddie Neloy. George had a lot of good trainer friends in New York that used to send him a lot of horses. So the introduction to horse racing, I got to meet a lot of people that you'd normally not meet in New England. And they were an influence on me.
So outside of George Handy, Ned, who had the biggest influence on your career?
Well, when I would go back to Tenafly, New Jersey in the winter to go back to school, I galloped horses in New York for Mac Miller. And he had horses for Charles Englehart at the time. And he had a horse by the name of Fort Marcy. And he really incited the real excitement in the game because he had a lot of really nice horses in Belmont, Aqueduct, and Saratoga. I mean, they still are the epitome of racing, but even back then, it was really exciting, and my interest and my excitement's always been there.
Was Max
it is today?
Was Mac Miller's style different than George Handy?
Excuse me.
Was Mac Miller's style a little bit different than George Handy?
Oh yeah. I mean, it's, you know, racing at Suffolk Downs in New England was a little bit different than racing in New York. I mean, Mac Miller had nothing but a barn full of potential superstars. Not all of them were, but so the game was played a little bit differently. But, you know, the bottom line is they both took really good care of their horses. They always did the right thing. And, you know, those are the things that influence you. Alan Jerkins was always a very dear friend of mine and used to spend a lot of time at his barn when I'd go to New York. And it was an absolute pleasure having some friends like that in the business that, they could tell you stories that would make you a better horseman.
Yeah, Alan had such an influence on so many people in the game today, and so many trainers that have come on this program over the years have told us that Alan Jerkins was a major reason for their success, and it sounds like you would agree with that statement, Ned.
Oh, without a doubt, without a doubt. I mean, George Handy I came up under, but the associations I had with guys like Mac Miller and Alan Jerkins were just the cream on the top.
You think about being a kid, as you said, just, you know, showing up at the barn the next day and thinking, okay, I'm going to give this sport a shot because you fell in love with it, love at first sight, as you described it. And then you're working with people like George Handy and Mac Miller, and you're around guys like Alan Jerkins. Do you ever just kind of look back and say, how on earth did I get so lucky?
Yeah, you certainly do, because, you know, you have so many friends in the game that never had those opportunities and just worked really hard and never had the success that those guys had, or even myself. I feel like I've been very lucky, very fortunate. You know, we don't really make the horses make us. And you've got to find, you know, you've got to hope that some good owners ask you to train their horses, and that's where the opportunity comes, you know. And guys like Peter Fuller and Bill Campbell and Charlie Mathis and Dr. Torsney, I mean, I could go on for a half hour just telling you about some of the really good owners that I had, and they stuck with me from day one to the time that they passed away. And, you know, you have to feel very fortunate and very lucky that you were able to be associated with those type of owners.
What's the key to developing a solid, long-lasting relationship between an owner and a trainer?
Well, I think, number one, you've got to win. Number two, you've got to be honest. Number three, you've got to be accurate with your predictions. Because if you're wrong a lot, you know, they're going to lose interest in you. So I think that it's just a matter of being very honest, being fair to the horse, not abusing them, and winning some races. Winning is everything. You've got to win.
Yeah, that cures everything, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Talking with trainer Ned Allard on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Ned, you mentioned galloping horses for Mac Miller, and you mentioned your interest initially in wanting to be a jockey. When did you realize that maybe that wasn't going to work out?
Well, when I was 5'11", weighed 97 pounds up until the time I was 16. But I was starting to do a lot of running. I was starting to watch my diet, and it just all caught up to me. You know, I just wasn't going to be strong enough to make it as a jock. I was going to be too big. And I just, you know, it was a no-brainer. Well, if I can't be a jock, then I'm going to try to be a trainer.
Did you ever have the chance to ride in any races?
No, in fact, I didn't. I was very close. And in fact, I almost succumbed to malnutrition. And was lucky to have a good doctor to look after me and nurse me back to health. And that's as close as I came.
Things were a little different back then, too. You couldn't just show up at the racetrack. It was a little more difficult to become a jockey in those days, I think, than it is today. Is that fair?
Oh, without a doubt. Without a doubt. I think that your apprenticeship with a trainer had to be long, and you had to be a hard worker. There's a lot of things that took place back in the old days that isn't quite as prevalent nowadays.
I'm always curious. A lot of trainers that I've talked with over the years, Ned, have talked about how they wanted to be a jockey. Many of them, like, say, a Wesley Ward, were an accomplished jockey. And then they went on to the training side of things, and it's worked out pretty well. How much did that experience of being around the horses, learning from the ground up, and then getting on them in the mornings, how much does that help you when you're training them?
I think the whether you're on the ground or whether you're on their back or whether you're helping the veterinarian or helping the blacksmith, all those experiences lend to you being a better horseman because, you know, in order to be a good trainer, you have to be a little bit of a blacksmith, a little bit of a veterinarian, a little bit of an owner. You've got to have some experience in all aspects of the game so you know what to do. The more you know, the smarter you are, and then you hope that you've got to get a little lucky, too.
All right, so tell me about the day that you first decided to go out on your own and start training horses.
Well, while I was with George Sandy, there was a man in New York that had, by the name of John Amirati. John Amirati had horses with Alan Jerkins, and I'm sorry, with Eddie Neloy, and he had a horse by the name of Fleetness Rules, and through Eddie Neloy's assistant trainer, Noah Caton, they sent the horse up to me, and George allowed me to have one horse. And I had that horse for about 6 months. He was by Fleetness Rules, Fleetness Ruler. And when George left New England in 1970 to go to Liberty Bell, I had that horse all ready to run, and the purses were only $1,500, so it wasn't a big deal. But the first time I ran him, he won. The second time I ran him, he won. And then I thought, well, you know what? Maybe I'll stick around and see if I can get some more horses to train, which happened on a daily basis. For some reason, I just kept on getting new owners. And Lincoln Downs was 1970. I believe I ended up second leading trainer at that meet. And that's how it all started.
So you won with your very first starter.
Well, I, in fact, with my first two starters.
Were you thinking, hey, this isn't so hard?
He was a really neat horse.
Were you thinking this is an easy game?
No, because when I was working for Handy, I was making more money than I was training horses at the time. You know, $1,500, that's 900 to the winner. That's a $90 10%. So, I mean, it's hard to make it on that kind of money. But, again, you know, you get bitten by the game, and it's a strange phenomenon.
Tell me about Lincoln Downs. If I remember, it was a prominent racetrack for a very long time.
Narragansett and Lincoln Downs were very prominent. They were the two Rhode Island racetracks, and they usually raced in the fall. Sometimes, yeah, it was always a fall meet or a winter meet. And again, it was a little before my time, but because I started in 70 and I was with George in 57, I'm going to say in the 30s and 40s, those two racetracks were you know, major league racetracks. They were both outside of Providence, Rhode Island. And, you know, the big cities that had racetracks, you know, Suffolk Downs was also one of them. They did very well. But, again, the gambling dollar kind of caught up to the game.
What was the biggest challenge that Ned Allard faced when you were first getting started?
Trying to make enough money to survive. you know, Alan Jerkins told me a story. He, I think it was Phil Johnson and maybe even Pancho Martin. They were both, all three of them were just getting started training horses. And they were both on the van from Belmont over to Aqueduct. And when they got there, they all wanted to buy a cup of coffee from Red the Baker, and neither one of them had the quarter to buy a coffee. And I thought, wow, Jerkins, Pancho Martin, Eddie Neloy didn't have a quarter on them. So, I mean, there you go. That kind of tells you the story.
Well, everybody has to start somewhere, right?
Exactly.
I can remember, Ned, that Bill Mott came on this program, and he talked about when he was getting started, and he was at Centennial Park, and he couldn't get stalls because his horses weren't good enough. Think about that.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
Yeah, and then you walk down the shed row, and there's five Hall of Famers. So,
and Billy Mott's a great guy. Not only is he a great guy, he's a superb horseman.
Yeah, just absolutely spectacular. Ned Allard on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. So how long did it take you to start feeling comfortable that you were starting to get things rolling, you were starting to have a little money in your pocket? How long did that take, Ned?
It took about a good 5 years. The first 5 years were a struggle with some inexpensive claiming horses and a little different clientele, you know, guys that own gas stations and were hard workers themselves, but they liked the game, and they'd, you know, they'd have $4,000 or $5,000 to invest, and that's all. And if things didn't go so well, they were gone. And then as soon as I started lighting up the board a little bit, you know, then I started getting some different clientele. And Peter Fuller was one of my earlier ones, and he strived for success and tried to breed a better horse. And then I started winning some stakes. And when I started winning some stakes, more people ended up taking notice. And, you know, Peter led John Costello, who owned the Lowell Sun newspaper. And then it led to Gil Campbell. And then it led to Charlie Mathis. And I think the number, and I'm not sure that the number, but the racing form told me that, you know, I've compiled 170 stakes, which is a lot of stakes. They're not the same as New York, but, you know, when you start winning better races, they start paying attention to you. And then things just fell in place, and I started feeling good. But it took a good 5 or 6 years before that happened.
I'm always curious when people tell me that, you know, first of all, you have to be ultra persistent, and you have to stick with it. And you have to stick with it through a lot of, let's call it, down times where things aren't going so well until you get to the point where you can finally start feeling comfortable. And as you said, for you, it was 5 years, Ned. Was there ever a time in that 5 years where you said, boy, maybe I didn't make the right decision?
No, never felt that way. In fact, you know, up until last year, I had a good 7 year run of not winning any stakes and not winning any fancy races. And even at that, you don't think about quitting. You just hope things turn around.
What's the key to persevering through those kind of times?
I don't think we know any better. You know, it's ingrained in you. I mean, it's something you started doing at a very young age, and you don't know any better. You know, I think an intelligent decision for a lot of trainers would have been try something else, and some of them do. I mean, there's a lot of stewards that are around. A lot of my assistants turned out to be stewards rather than racehorse trainers because they thought this game was a little bit tough. I know Van Berg had a wonderful quote. He said, "This is the greatest game played outdoors. The only trouble is you outlive your money."
Yeah, that's the truth. As people say in the sport, you have to have your big boy pants on if you want to play.
Yeah.
Yeah, so true.
It's a challenge. You don't see any trainers retiring. They just kind of pass away.
You know, I remember. Yeah. Yeah. Unfortunately, that's correct. And so many.
What a way to go. I mean, you know, to find something you love that much that you don't want to retire. I mean, I don't even know what retire means. You're going to train until you drop dead. I mean, that's pretty cool, I think.
And I don't
to
think.
Have something your entire life that feels so good that you'd rather do that than anything else in the world. I mean, you're a lucky guy if that's the case.
Yeah, you never work a day in your life, right? When it's like
7 days a week, it's a lot of work, it's a lot of stress, but you wouldn't trade it for anything.
Right, and I don't think you can be successful as a horse trainer unless you have that love of the game and that passion. Is that right?
Oh, positively. You have to have it. Because there's a lot of struggling times that you've got to work through, and if you didn't have the tremendous appreciation of the game, you'd never keep doing it.
How about your family, Ned? How about the support of your family? How important is that?
I you know, I've got two daughters that are now mothers themselves. They always loved the game. They never got into it as far as working at the track, but they're in the banking business and the insurance business, and they still love horses. They still ride. They still have some in the show, and the love has always been there for them too, but they were smart enough to pick different careers.
Do they still come to the races when you have a horse
in a big race? They love it. They love it. I was lucky enough to meet a gal 35 years ago when I had horses at the Rockets Mill Farm in Doswell, Virginia. That's where Mom's Command was broken and trained. And it's a gal by the name of Mary Catherine, we've been married now, I don't know, 28 years. And she's my assistant trainer, and she loves the game just as much as I do.
And that's important. That's critical, because you have to have somebody that understands the hours you're going to put in.
Yep. Oh, yeah, because, you know, most people would say, hey, you like the horses more than you like me. And unfortunately, that's sometimes the case. The horses can't talk back.
Yeah, this is very, very true. Ned Allard on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Just a minute or two left before we have to get to the break, and we'll continue our conversation in the second half of the show for you here this evening. Ned, I do want to ask you about, you talked about your propensity for winning stakes races in New England and at those racetracks. In 2009, you were inducted into the New England Turf Writers Association Hall of Fame, and you went in with people like Chris McCarron and Gilbert Campbell, who was a longtime owner and breeder, even Champion Seabiscuit getting inducted that year.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, tell me about that honor.
It was great. I mean, it was something you don't really think about, that kind of stuff. But when it was all said and done, it was time to pick a trainer for the Hall of Fame. And I guess they look up your record and say, hey, this guy deserves to be there, and it's a real honor.
Do you get a plaque or a jacket or anything?
Oh, yeah, you get a plaque, and you get the recognition of being a New England Hall of Fame trainer, which George Handy was, and Ronald Dandy, and a number of us that have been lucky enough to get there. But, you know, you got to win some races, and you have to have won some stakes and done something a little bit special, and for them to acknowledge that, hey, it's a nice thing to have happen.
Well, Ned Allard has been winning races and winning stakes races for a very long time. He's still doing it to this day. We're going to take a break. We'll come back, and we'll look back on some of those moments in his career, including a very special horse by the name of Mom's Command. We'll do that next on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. In 2015, the Fasig Tipton selected yearling sales outperformed all major North American yearling sales. The July sale, held in Lexington, Kentucky, is annually a top-ranked yearling sale by percentage of graded stakes winning graduates, and saw 15 sires represented by their highest-priced colt or filly in 2015. The prestigious Fasig Tipton Saratoga sale posted an increased average of over $322,000 while boasting a remarkably low RNA rate of just 15%, and was tremendously strong in the middle market, with a higher percentage of horses sold in the $100,000 to $300,000 range than book one of the Keeneland September sale. The New York bred sale in Saratoga produced 50 yearlings of $100,000 or higher, with an increased average of more than $81,000. The Fasig Tipton selected yearling sales, superior results. Visit FasigTipton.com.
Plume Racing.
Majestic City could also still do it, and here he comes.
Majestic City running a big one.
Started by former jockey and 35-year racing industry veteran Jeffrey Plume, Plume Racing offers racing partnerships, bloodstock services, pinhooking, and private race management.
Soul Driver the leader, though. Soul Driver in front.
Experience the fun, excitement, and exclusive access of racehorse ownership with Plume Racing. Forming racing partnerships now. Get in on the action at PlumeRacing.com.
It all started with a dream. A dream to be the best. To breed the best. To race the best.
Super Saver Ross Amaya, what a finish to the contest.
And to stand the best. Windstar Farm, dedicated to the dream.
And they're off to New York, the premier state bred program in the United States. When you own a New York bred, your horse can run for more than $44 million in purses restricted to registered New York breds. And the New York program pays awards to breeders, owners, and stallion owners when their New York breds finish first, second, or third at New York tracks. We have the quality.
Day at the spa, all the way.
You have the opportunity. New York breds, get with the program. The best program.
This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
They approach the top of the stretch. Mom's Command is still drawing clear. They're at the top of the stretch. Mile and a quarter and 203 and one. Mom's Command continues to go clear, now has the lead by six. Kaluk 2, Jill second by a length, Bessarabian on the rail, moving up in third on the outside, Foxy Dean further out is Denver Express, they pass the eighth pole. Looks like Mom's Command can do it. This is going to be a filly Triple Crown winner. Mom's Command with Abigail Fuller aboard winning by about six lengths, then Bessarabian is second. It's Mom's Command in front.
Mom's Command pulling off that victory at Belmont Park in the 1985 Coaching Club American Oaks. That win secured her the Philly Triple Crown, or the Triple Tierra, as it used to be known in New York, where you win the Acorn, the Mother Goose, and cap it off with a victory in the Coaching Club American Oaks. As we know, Mom's Command would go on to be inducted into Horse Racing's Hall of Fame, and she is trained by Ned Allard, who is our special guest on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton this evening. Welcome back to the program, Mike Penna, in our Lexington studios. Really fun visit in the first half of the show, and extremely excited to talk about Mom's Command and some of the other outstanding horses that Ned has been around in his career in the second half of the show. Quick reminder that if you missed any portion, you can go to our website, horseracingradio.net. You can listen to a podcast of this program and all of our talk shows at your convenience, horseracingradio.net and Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes. Ned, how about that victory in the Coaching Club American Oaks? What a special win.
That was a very special win. She was a very special horse. You know, a lot of people would say, when did you know she was a good horse? Well, you find out as time goes on. I wish I could say I was smart enough to know she was a superstar from the start, but you never really know that. They have to prove it to you. And it's always easier to let the horse do the talking than you mouthing off about how good they are. She just, you know, she won her first start as a two-year-old filly up at Rockingham, and Peter Fuller was selling her one of her sisters in the sale, and he said to me, he said, wouldn't it be great if we could get her stakes placed? I said, well, when's the sale? He said, it's in 3 weeks. I'm thinking, how are we going to accomplish that? He says, well, if you really like her, how about we run her as a first-time starter in the stake. I said, wow. I was a little disappointed that he wanted me to do that, as I think back. But she won that day and won her next start at Suffolk Downs. And, you know, I started thinking this filly might be a little bit special, but that's all in New England. And then we went to New York and we won a few more stakes. We won the Salima. As a two-year-old, you could tell she was going to be something special as long as she stayed sound and continued on that way. We ran her in the Hollywood Starlet, and rather than the Breeders' Cup, the very first year they ran it, and she drew the 17 hole, was 15 wide for the first mile, and only got beat at like 2.5 lengths. So I think with any racing luck in a better post, she'd have won that, but she didn't. And we stopped on her for the winter, and we brought her back in the Flirtation Stakes at Pimlico. That was her first race as a three-year-old, and it was in the mud, and she won by 21 lengths. And then she won the Cherry Blossom, and then we went to New York, and the rest is history. But just a sensational race mare.
Had you ever started a first-timer in a stakes race to that point?
No, I had not. And I don't think I have since. You know, it's got to be some really unusual circumstances for you to want to do that, or a very ambitious owner that you don't want to lose over fighting with him about not doing it. So, I mean, I don't think that happens too often.
Well, she won grade one.
There was a maiden in the Derby this year. So, I mean, it does happen, but
yeah,
it's very unusual.
She won grade ones like the Salima Stakes at Laurel that you mentioned. She won the Acorn, the Mother Goose, the Coaching Club American Oaks, and then capped off her career with that victory in the Alabama at Saratoga.
At Saratoga, yep. Yeah.
What was her most impressive performance in your eyes?
I think the American Coaching Club, because no one thought that pedigree would go a mile and a half. And she was just an incredible horse. Abby fit her to a T. She just kind of let her go and do her own thing. And it was just a very special time. Not only did the Peter Fuller breed the horse, he bred the daughter. So, I mean, what better story is that?
Yeah, you breed a Hall of Fame horse, and then you breed a jockey like Abby Fuller. And, he certainly had everything going in the right direction. Tell me about Abby. Why was she such a good fit for Mom's Command?
Well, I think because Abby was very patient and didn't get in her way. And, Mom just had a tremendous amount of early speed, and she had the stamina to hang on. And it's a number of times at the head of the stretch, it looked like she was going to get caught, and then she'd kick away and open up another four or five lengths. And there were a number of days where it looked like everyone behind her was just getting drunk chasing her. She just had a unique style that I wish I had a few more like that.
Yeah, they're hard to come by.
But I'm glad that I had one. People will say, boy, don't you wish you had a couple more of Mom's Command? I'm glad I just had one of them.
It's a huge thrill. And when you're around those horses, it does make you want another one because you realize how good they are and you kind of get a taste of it, right?
Oh, positively. But, you've been around long enough, it's not going to last forever. The chances of you getting another one are probably pretty slim, but just the experience of having one of them is great. I'll tell you one amusing story. Again, I told you I worked for Mac Miller while I was in school. And one day I had to get home and I wanted to borrow $10 on him on Friday. And the assistant trainer, Jack Dwyer, who went on with Kelso, told me there's no draw on the job. So I thought, well, I'm not drawing. I'm just looking to borrow $10 to get home. And I went into the office at Belmont, asked Mac Miller, and his glasses slid down on his nose, and he looked up at me. He said, I'd love to, Ned, but there's no draw on this job. And he wouldn't give it to me. I couldn't believe it. Well, Jack ended up giving me the $10. But, then 30 years later, I'm walking down to the winner's circle, and in the third leg of the Triple Crown, and I walk by Mac Miller, and he jumps up, shakes my hand, says, what a wonderful job you did with that poor son. He said, but there's still no draw in this job. I damn near fell on the ground laughing. I thought that was so funny. I couldn't believe that he remembered it.
Wow, what a great story. Yeah, and you think about that accomplishment, winning that Philly Triple Crown, or as they called it, the Triple Tierra.
Right.
That was a very difficult feat to accomplish.
Oh, positively. Positive. In your wildest dreams, you don't see things like you don't think things like that are going to happen.
Well, Mom's Command retired with 11 wins from 16 starts. Every single start, as you just heard, came in a stakes race. She was inducted into the Hall of Fame in 2007. What was that day like, Ned?
Oh, that was wonderful. I mean, That's the ultimate in honors and the ultimate in a personal accomplishment that you had something to do with it.
I read a story
it
about.
Doesn't get better than that.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't. I read a story about owner breeder Peter Fuller, who we talked about a little bit here. I read that he was a Golden Gloves boxing champion. Is that correct?
Yeah, and a good one too. A good one. I think he was undefeated as a Golden Gloves fighter, and he was undefeated as a wrestler at Harvard University, too. I mean, he was a tough guy, loved the sport. I was working for George Handy when Dancer's Image won the Derby, and he got taken down. I thought that was just an absolute travesty for Pete, especially seeing that with Butazolidine at the time, and I'm I'm sure he wasn't the only horse on a little butte at the time, but that was tough stuff. So for me to follow up that act and come up with a horse like Mom's Command, you know, that was a real treat.
How tough was it when you got the news that Peter had passed away on May 14th of 2012?
Well, I still had horses for him at the time. We were still staying in touch. One day, a friend of mine called me from New Hampshire and said, "You got to get up and see Pete. You know, he's not doing well. I don't think he's going to make it." And I had been talking to Pete, and he said he just had a bad back. So I jumped in my car, and I went scampering up there. It was right around Derby time, and he was in his, you know, in a home, and you know, you could tell he was on his way out. And I spent a good full day with him 2 days before he passed away, and it was the most satisfying day I'd ever spent with one of my owners. I mean, it was just an incredible experience. I loved the guy. He was a great sportsman. He was a loyal owner. I used to tell everybody he was the Elizabeth Arden of New England, but he never fired me.
You know, it speaks to that relationship that we talked about in the first half of the program and developing those relationships with specific owners, and it sounds like this one was just a match made in heaven.
It was. He was a... In fact, I'm cheering up a little bit just telling you the story because, you know, just a really special guy.
Well, I know Abby's still around the racetracks quite a bit. What's it like when you see her?
We stay in touch. We text each other and send each other pictures every now and then. She congratulates me when a horse runs real big. And Peter's oldest son, I talk to every now and then. I've been in touch with the family. And it's, you know, it's been a very special relationship.
Visiting with trainer Ned Allard here on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. Ned, tell me about some of the other horses that came along after Mom's Command that you're just never going to forget.
Well, one filly was a filly by the name of Miss Indiana. And I had her for a good friend of Mr. Campbell's, Charlie Mathis. And she came to me in the spring as a three-year-old. And she broke her maiden at Suffolk by 21 lengths and then went on to win a number of stakes. Pat Day, the last time I ran her, she ran in, I'm going to call it the Budweiser Breeders' Cup, but it wasn't Breeders' Cup. It was a $300,000 grade two stake at Churchill. And Pat Day rode her for me, and she won that day. Now, if I'm not mistaken, she won like 7 out of 11 starts, too. She was a really special racehorse. And then, you know, I had Thrills for Real for Gil Campbell. And she ended up making like $650,000 and won a number of stakes. And she was a really good racehorse. Between Fuller and Mr. Campbell, I'll guarantee you there's 100 stakes right there.
Wow. Just with those two owners.
Yep. And, you know, Gil, I bought him. He came to the racetrack one day with Peter and Johnny Costello, and he was interested in getting in the game. And we ended up getting his first horse off of Mr. Vanderbilt, a horse by the name of Ski Resort. And that horse did very well. I don't think I won a stake with him, but he won a number of allowance races and a couple of handicaps. And Gil got the bug, and he's just gone on with it ever since. His record speaks for itself.
By the way, you're correct on that Budweiser Breeders' Cup. It was actually called the Churchill Downs Budweiser Breeders' Cup Handicap, a grade two in 1993 when you won it with Miss Indiana.
Right, right. I knew it was, I would have had to look it up. But, she was a special racehorse too.
Well, I started the show talking about going from Mom's Command with your first graded stake in 1984 to Always Sunshine, who won recently, the Maryland Sprint Handicap, a grade three. And just curious, Ned, what's the key to being able to play at this very high level for such a long time?
You've got to have some good owners and some good horses. You know, you can't win races with an empty stall, and you can't win stakes with a claiming horse. not usually. You've got to be just one of those fortunate guys that some of the better owners still like what you're doing for them, and then magic happens. But it's and you need good help, you need good assistance. You know, there's so many things that play into it. It's not a me situation. You know, you need a lot of help.
What's the key
to... The day you think you're the one that's making it happen, you're just kidding yourself. You need a lot of things to happen to come up with good horses and make it all work.
What's the key to assembling a good team? It sounds like you've done that.
Well, I've got kids that have worked for me 15, 16 years. I've had a few that worked for me for 20 years. And I think that... when you appreciate the good job they do for them, they appreciate the good job you do for them. It's a working relationship. When they do a good job and you do a good job and the horses are running big, hey, everybody wants to be with a good horse if they can. So it's a contribution of. From a lot of directions.
Do trainers set goals for themselves, Ned?
Well, it's difficult because you have anticipations. You know, I think maybe a horse wins his first race, he wins his second race, and then you start thinking, well, maybe I can win a minor stake. Everything gets adjusted from almost day one. And I think if you try to project too much, you lose the important factor, and that's on a day-to-day basis. A lot of things can happen, so you really have to keep an open mind.
So what?
And, you know, if you set your goals too high, you're just going to constantly be disappointed, and you're going to disappoint a lot of people that you train for, too. You've got to be a little bit careful to not get owners all excited on a lot of horses that don't materialize, or, you know, because then again, you're not producing what you say you're going to produce.
Well, you've accomplished so much in your career. You've had a lot of success. You've won so many big races. What's still left on that Ned Allard bucket list that you would love to accomplish in this game?
I just hope that I get to continue to train some nice horses until it's time to go to rest. Guys like Woody Stevens and Sonny Jim Fitzsimmons and George Handy and Alan Jerkins. I mean, I just hope I'm still in the game, when I'm 90. Whether you're winning a lot of stakes, just having some horses to train and enjoy the game, that's all you can ask for.
Is the thrill of winning still the same today as it was when you first started?
Positively. I mean, winning is so much fun. It's hard to describe how big a thrill it is. I mean, think of some of the wealthy people in the world that have horses and will lose a fortune, keep on doing it, and love every minute of it. You know, whether it's the Queen of England or Gil Campbell or Peter Blum or you name it. I mean, people that have made fortunes, Paul Mellon. They didn't need horse racing, but, you know, they got a taste of it, and it became their hobby, their way of life, an extension of what they stood for. It's pretty amazing. You know, if it works for them, it's kind of easy to figure out how it can work for us.
Ned Allard on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Ned, when you're around good horses, and you told me with Mom's Command, you knew pretty soon that she could run. How long does it take you to know when a horse has what it takes to be good?
They have to be tested. I mean, it's easy to think you've got a really nice horse, but then you've got to go out there and they've got to prove it. You don't have to prove it. The horses have to prove it. And you just don't know how far they're going to go. I mean, the day I remember watching Secretariat get beat by Onion at Saratoga, I thought, how does something like that happen? So even the best of them can get beaten on a given day. But The great ones just keep on trucking. And until you get one, you don't really know it. I'd like to have a nickel for every horse I thought was going to be something special. But, you know, something happens along the way that they don't get there, whether it's infirmities or they just didn't have it to begin with. There's a number of reasons why a lot of horses don't turn into good horses. But the good ones are really special. The Michael Jordans and the Tiger Woods and the Arnold Palmers and the, you know, they're far and few between, and you're in awe of them all the time.
Were you at Saratoga the day that Onion beat Secretariat?
No, I wasn't there that day, but I watched it. I watched it, and in disbelief, I couldn't believe it. But, you know, Jerkins being one of my heroes, all-time heroes, it didn't surprise me. He was a giant killer then, and he's gone. He's still a giant killer.
Yeah, now his son Jimmy kind of following in those footsteps, I guess, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, they're big shoes to fill. You know, the game is just a complete fascination.
How much different is the game today than when you first started?
Well, I think it's just like everything. I mean, everything has changed over time. The racing game has changed. The automobile business has changed. Politics has changed. I mean, yeah, everything in life changes. And I think that they always have. It's just that the older you get, the more you think they've changed. But if you got to live 400 years, you say, hey, this has been going on forever.
Do you spend much time, Ned, around the sales and picking out young horses now, or do you not have to do much of that?
Well, I never had to do a lot of it because I always trained for breeders. But, you know, there was plenty of times that Gil, Peter, Charlie, everybody would like to buy a two-year-old or a yearling. But I haven't done a lot of that. I've done my share of it, but never really had to rely on trying to buy horses to fill my stable up.
Well, that's kind of a nice luxury to have, isn't it?
Oh, positively. Positively.
Ned Allard on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Ned, I always enjoy kind of asking a personal question of our trainers and asking them what other hobbies or things they might enjoy doing when they're not at the racetrack. So I know I called you a couple of weeks ago to ask you to come on the program, and you were out walking one of your dogs. What other things does Ned Allard enjoy doing?
Well, I love animals in general, love dogs. My grandfather was a dairy farmer, and in my house, I have as many cow pictures on the walls as I do horse pictures. And anytime I go to someplace like Penn National, I go through the Amish country, I'm always pulling over the side of the road and taking a picture of a good cow. Just nature in general is wonderful. I've always enjoyed the water, although I've never fished. Nature is an amazing thing at every level, whether it's going by a cornfield or some hay or some straw or some cow fields or whatever, makes me feel good.
Do you get much time to get away from the barn now and spend some time out there in nature?
No, you don't. No, you don't. When I tell you those stories, they're usually because I'm on my way up to Penn National, or I'm down on my way down to Pimlico, or they're usually in the travels going from one track to another. But you always have 5 minutes to pull over and soak up some good cow manure or something. You know, it's a great way to go.
You know, when you were talking about Mom's Command, you mentioned some other names in your comparison, where you mentioned names like Tiger Woods and Michael Jordan and Arnold Palmer. Are there other sports that you'll follow throughout the year?
Well, I don't really follow any other sports. I love them, but the horse racing game really is a 24-hour job. I don't really go to football games. I don't go to basketball games. But I love all those sports, and I think that anytime you see somebody that's exceptionally good, hey, you're in awe of them.
Ned, only a couple of minutes left, and this hour has really gone by quite quickly. one question that I always have to ask every trainer that comes on here, because the answers are so diverse, is this. When you look back on your career, what is it that you're most proud of?
That I'm still in it. And I still have some good owners, and I still have some good horses, and I just feel very, very fortunate.
Well, you're in it, and you're in it at a very high level. Just a couple of weeks ago, you ran a horse, Abiding Star, in the Preakness Stakes, and the horse came into the race in great form, I guess on a five-race winning streak, and you told me, hey, he deserved his opportunity.
He did. He deserved the opportunity. If you can't take a shot after winning five races with a three-year-old and a couple of stakes, you know, it didn't seem too far-fetched, although you realize you'd never run against that kind. And he had a unique style of liking to be left alone on the lead. And the first quarter of a mile in the Preakness was history for me. A number of reporters asked if I had any excuse, and all I could tell them was, when I got to the barn the next morning, the horse called me over to the stall and said he appreciated the fact that I had enough confidence in him to take a shot in that race, but please don't do that again. Pick me some softer company.
Where are we going to see Abiding Star next?
There's a stake at Monmouth Park. It's a grade three. I believe it's on the 19th, and that might be our next spot. You know, it'll be staying away from all the monsters and hopefully put him back on a winning note.
Well, nobody better than, Ned Allard, who is our guest tonight on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. Ned, can't thank you enough for spending some time with us here today. Really do appreciate it. Great stories, amazing career. You're a credit to the game. And as many people have told me in the weeks leading up to this interview, they said Ned Allard is one of the nicest guys you're going to meet in the sport of thoroughbred racing. So keep it going.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah, keep it going, my friend. And like all of our guests who appear on the program, you're going to receive a gift courtesy of one of our sponsors. It's Flair Equine Nasal Strips. We'll get those to you, and really do appreciate all the time here tonight, Ned.
Well, you're quite welcome, and it was fun.
All right, best of luck in the future here.
Thank you.
Ned Allard here on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. Don't forget, if you did miss any portion of that show, go to our website, horseracingradio.net. The podcast will be up shortly after we finish up here at 7 o'clock Eastern Time. You can listen to this show and all of our Trainer Talk shows. And, by the way, all of our Jock Talk shows, equine forum programs, call-in shows, and all of our Express Bet Radio programs as well, with our selections every Friday night. It's all there for you, horseracingradio.net and Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes. Great story. So much success in this game. And really, one of the true good guys in the sport of thoroughbred racing. He's done it the right way. He's learned from the ground up. And Ned Allard still winning graded stakes to this very day. That's what this show is all about. And we appreciate you joining us here tonight on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. For my producer, Lee Delapina, for special guest Ned Allard, I'm Mike Penna. We'll talk to you next week right here on Trainer Talk, all presented by our friends at Fasig Tipton.